The pilots did not like the runway because you came in and you went aimed right into a big steep mountain, and that's what they didn't like. And because Dick was a commercial airlines pilot before he became a fisherman, he knew a lot of the pilots, and he told me stories and stuff of how they didn't like that mountain. Anyway, wing got twice as big, and then they went out of business, and then Mark Air came in, and they actually kept business out. They kept their competition out, and that was kind of hard for Kodiak. I came in when it was $27. I think that was round trip. And I tell you, I really got mad when they jumped that up to $35. Now, I can't even, what is the price now? In the hundreds, close to $300 to get off this island? And back if you wanted to really be that desperate. But anyway, I complained when I went up to $35. I can't believe this. But that was the price of an airplane ticket in 1968. No, $27 in 68. In 1970, I think it was 35. You know, I didn't take the ferry very much. That was a long, long ride. And but my husband, since he was a pilot, we owned our own airplane, and we had a 150 in those days. And we went to Seattle in a 150. And because he wasn't used to going over the water in a 150, believe me, you should see this plane. It was only two seats, and we had to have all the survival gear. And we went to Seattle to, oh, a school reunion. That's what it was. I think it was his 20-year school reunion. His 40th is coming up here come July. But he got, by the way, mentioned because he came the longest, the hardest way. And I guarantee you, when they said the hardest way, it was the hardest way. We followed the road system. We went up towards Anchorage. We followed land because it was a small plane. And we took a pistol. By the way, pistols are not allowed in Canada. You have to have a gun to leave to be in Alaska. You can't have a pistol in Canada, and you can't arrive in Seattle with a gun. So we had fun with that, but and we wouldn't have protected ourselves from a bear anyway, but not with a .22 pistol. But the law says you had to have a gun on board for survival, and that's all we had. Anyway, we flew to Seattle in the 150, and looking down, I was the navigator, and we looked down, and we'd follow the road, the Alcan all the way, and the cars were going faster than us. I couldn't believe it. It was really bumpy. We were really bucking the headwinds all the way, and it took us longer than those cars to get to Seattle. And at one point, it was so bad that we had to take all our survival gear out at one airport, and I can't remember what part of Canada this was in, and put it in an airline and ship it ahead. And this is all our survival gear, mind you, all our survival gear. We're shipping that ahead where we needed it the most, and putting a barrel of fuel on board. Now, first of all, you guys don't realize I'm a white knuckle flyer anyway, so this is not helping me any. So we put the fuel on board. And my husband says, but I don't know if I can reach the wings if we have to stop and fuel. And I said, hon, if we're going to a runway that is a survival strip, I'm sure there's going to be something. And rightfully so, there was logs that people stood on. And the runways were covered with strawberries, and I would eat strawberries when my husband was fueling. Anyway, and we couldn't have made it without stopping at this strip along this river. And oh, I just can't think of the name of it now. But anyway, we did make it to Seattle. And the longest part of the whole trip, besides the bumpy ride down, was my husband always believes in landing at the beginning of the runway. But in a 150, when you're at SeaTac, it's like you're traveling to another state all on the runway, because customs is on the other end. It was just on the other end. We get there, and the custom agent wasn't there, and a replacement person was there, and he didn't know his job or what he was supposed to do, and we arrived with this pistol. You have to declare everything. And the Canadian government had sealed it in a bag, and it has to be sealed. Well, like I said, we can't arrive with a gun either, but this is stuff we didn't know. And I said, well, we'll give you the gun. And they said, we can't accept the gun. But you can't have the gun. And I said, but what are we going to do with the gun? And we went around and around for hours about this stupid gun. that, you know, was sealed in a bag. He wouldn't take it. We couldn't even give it away. We couldn't throw it away. We couldn't keep it. So what are we going to do? Well, anyway, we all compromised after being very worn out and very hungry and tired, and it ended up under our seat in the airplane. Remember, we're still not supposed to have this gun. And it stayed under the seat of our airplane the whole time. And then we went back. And the customs agent, an older man in Canada, he did give us some very friendly advice. And he said, get an over-under. That's, you take it apart and you put it under your seat. That way you can have a rifle in Canada. You just can't have a pistol. And so when we went back to Alaska, we did get a rifle. We've never shot it. We've never used it. I don't even know how to put it together. But that's what we ended up with and stuff. That was one of our many little trips. And then since then, we bought a 310, which is a five-seater, and we've been to Seattle and back and had some good times. And sorry. I want to talk about the King Crab Festival. The King Crab Festival is an annual fair. And when I was first married, that's when those hot dogs were around, the heaters. Well, that church had a booth in the King Crab Festival, and that's where they sold it. And I'm so thankful they got those hot dogs out of the church for my wedding. I think I would have just died. But anyway, the King Crab Festival has bounced around. It's early May, late May, and early May. They're trying to dodge the snow, but it doesn't matter. Snow comes anytime. And the kids, they don't care. These rides that come in, they'll ride them in the snow. I was going to say something about the King Crab Festival. In those days, it was called the Kodiak King Crab Festival because they actually did have king crab there at the fair. It was, I should say festival. Downtown, where one of the canneries, where that big ship is now, I can still see it. They had a big flat board by the ferry dock. That's where it was. They had a big flat board with 1, 2, 3, 4, maybe 5 on it, and a line. It was a big white board and a line on it. And the guys would gamble, and they'd have these king crabs, and they put it up at the top, and the board would be slanted at an angle. Let's see, it was about 45 degree angle or something like that. And they'd put the king crabs on it, and they'd see how far the king crab would walk. And they'd all gamble and make bets and see which crab went the furthest and got over the line. And I remember that clearly. And also, what I never did watch, I always turned away, was quite popular in those days. A lot of the old timers, Jim Fisk was one of the seal skinners. They had seal skin, they would take a small seal. And they would peel the skin off in front of everybody. They would be in their rustic garb, you know, their costumes of stuff. And they would actually, the men would take these seals, a lot of them baby seals, and they'd take their knives out and they'd see who could take the hide off a seal the fastest. And I could never watch that, but I clearly, clearly remember it every year for several years. And that's a thing of the past, for sure. But it was like someone shearing sheep somewhere in Australia, you know, but they would see who could skin the seal the fastest. And they don't do that anymore. And a lot of things they don't do anymore, and that's one I'm kind of glad they don't. That was getting towards summer. And of course, that was during my birthday and my anniversary. They were all about the same time and stuff. That first year I was here, when I came, being that I hadn't been out of Texas too long and only in Seattle for a short period of time, I really liked it warm. And when I got up here, it was in the 80s. It was really hot. Here, their 80s is a lot hotter than 80s anywhere else, because I don't know, the sun must be closer or something, but it was really hot. And my husband, he would say every day, he'd look at me and say, don't get used to this. Just don't get used to this. This is not the way Alaska is. Just don't get used to this. And I loved it. It just seemed really great to me. Anyway, also he says it's very bad for Kodiak. And I never did understand him. But when I was taking a shower once, anyway, some grass came out of the shower head onto my arm, just little pieces of brown grass, you know, and the water, I wonder if I'm getting dirtier taking a bath or cleaner, because the water was brown. It was just absolutely brown. And little flecks of grass would come out of the shower head. I'm surprised it didn't clog the whole thing up. But it was pretty gross and everything. My husband, being that he's a fisherman, and the canneries are what took up the water. They used our water, the fresh water, for their processing. And there was only a few canneries then. It wasn't a lot of canneries like they have now. And they all stayed in their own field, like I was telling you before. But our frequent trip would be up to the reservoir. When we see mud coming out of the water faucets and stuff, we go up to the reservoir. And that is the reservoir right behind where the Nazarene Church is now. That was the main water supply. And that would go right down to the bottom, right down to the mud. And so there wouldn't be any drinking water for the town. It'd be enough for the town. What they'd have to do was close down the canneries. And when they closed down the canneries, it hit the finances of the town, which was pretty, pretty bad. So we really relied on the snow and the rains, and which we did not have that year. And that was 1968, I believe. But 69, I think, too. But anyway, the canneries would close down. They have since built the new reservoirs. In fact, the main road going out towards Menashka, past the dump, there's a curve in the road, and that was the reservoir, the new reservoir, and that was considered the new reservoir, which fed into this reservoir. That's the one just right over this mountain, you know, that little spot. That was the end of the road. And in the wintertime, we'd go out there and see the deep, thick ice on top of it. Because even in the wintertime, you'd have water problems because it would turn into ice. And the water table would go down underneath the ice because my dogs would walk under that ice and come out somewhere else. It was really something. It was really kind of spooky. The ice would be several feet thick. And in fact, a lot of town people, that would be the meeting place. You know, you don't know it. You're just taking a drive. You go out to the road, you get out, look around at the ice. Say the water's dropped, you know, and you just have conversations. The same way with this other reservoir. But that was the newer reservoir, and that still ran out of water. And since then, we've gotten another reservoir after that. And that's why they've extended that road, is for the reservoirs, for the water to feed the town. But anyway, back to the canneries and stuff, they'd have to cut the canneries off because they used the fresh water to clean their canneries and stuff. And when my husband still fished, we didn't have the ethnic groups we have now. We have a lot of different people from a lot of different countries, a lot of Filipinos, Central and South Americans, and not too many Mexicans. In fact, when we were at that shipyard, the one person that helped us fix our boat was Tony Bravo. And I'm backtracking a little bit, but Tony Bravo should be mentioned because he was a very special guy, very nice Mexican guy, a shipwright that could come up to your boat and draw a picture of what he wanted on a piece of paper, and by just looking at something, and walk away and you wouldn't see him for days, and come back and put a whole new keel in your boat and it would fit just like a glove. He was very talented. He was caught in that shipyard fire, and there was a dog out there that called Pancho, that saved his life, that barked, and he woke up and he jumped down on a bunch of scrap steel. He only got out with his underwear, lost his visa and money, and had to be shipped back to Mexico. And he did come back for a short while. Right now, his descendants are here. They own the El Chicano, and a lot of his grandchildren are here, and he's living very well in Mexico somewhere, and very comfortable. But anyway, the Momar Inn that no longer exists was a very fantastic place on the roadside. Had one Filipino cook called, what was his name? Oh, I wish I could think of it, but he was really the best cook in town. He was the only only a couple of Filipinos, maybe two or three, and they came to Kodiak as cooks for the canneries, and this one was at the Momar Inn, and we used to bring our halibut off the boat you know, my husband believed in the waste not want that law of those days. Shrimp fishermen were not allowed to have the halibut on board, but it was dead anyway, so we gave our fish to the Baptist mission children. And when they were the big halibut, you know, you're talking the six-footers and stuff, the Baptist mission, just we asked them to come and get it and stuff, and they just loved it, and they showed the children how to. In those days, it was more of a home for the children from the villages so they could go to school. And they taught them how to butcher the fish and stuff like that. So they were real pleased with the halibut we gave them. We gave them fish all the time. And we gave this cook at the Momart Inn a fish, too. And you bring him in a fresh fish, and then you sit down and have dinner, and you ask for a dinner, and he'd bring you out twice as much food. It was really great. It was really good, too. He'd cook it up, and he'd come out, and he was so excited, this little tiny guy. If my husband was here, he could tell you the name. I wish I could remember. But anyway, those were the days when, you know, you're bringing food in, and they cook it for you, you know. When we had the Pacific Pearl fishing boat, you know, when my husband was gone and stuff, and since they didn't have all these different people, you know, they had set ladies that came in and did the processing of the fish and stuff. But I got notified one time that if I didn't show up one day, that they weren't going to process my husband's fish. And I took that as a threat, but this is the same guy that walked me down the aisle to get married. And I was, you know, I didn't know how to take this. And so I certainly didn't want to hinder my husband. And so I worked in the cannery. Two places my husband never asked me to work was, he pacified me, by the way. He said, oh yeah, you can go get a job. But he said, two places I don't want you to work, in a cannery or in a bar. Well, neither one. I wanted to work anyway. And then, he said it was okay to get a job, just to make me feel better, like I could go out and get one and stuff. But he truly never wanted me to work. But anyway, I did work in the cannery to help him, and that I didn't like the way I had to go about it, but it wasn't just myself. It was all the wives had to come in and help, or basically or else. One funny thing is, though, they gave me a paycheck that was great, but the bookkeeper had to come down, and he was my husband's best man. He had to explain to me why I got a negative check. And I have never seen a negative check before. And Jennifer, I know you're looking at me, but do you know what a negative check is? It's a check where you owe them after you worked a whole week. And I have never, ever in my life understood that. And he did explain it to me. He said, because here's your federal deduction, your state deduction, your this, that deduction, and then there's the $10 school tax, which they don't have anymore. But your first paycheck, they have to take the $10 school tax out. So I owe them $4 or $5. So I had to work another week, you know. And I just couldn't believe that. I just I shook my head, you know. And I didn't really mind working in a cannery. It just doesn't take a real brain to work in one. Just had to make sure there was nothing in with the shrimp and not get mesmerized by the belt moving, you know, and stuff. But I had been in an accident, so I was wearing one of those collars on my neck, and I had gone up to the office and to listen for the radio call from my husband. I was wearing one of these big collars on my neck, and I had fallen. This cannery was a floating cannery, and it was a ship. And so we were on ladders. And I went down the ladder all the way on my head. And I swear the owner was down there before me, and the cook, he was probably 350 pounds, big, tall, 6 foot black guy, was the cook. I tried to hold those steers back, but I couldn't. I really hurt bad because those were metal stairs, and I hit my head off. I went down forward and went down a whole flight. And so I stayed in the wheelhouse. I didn't have to go back to work right away. And I was very thankful for that. But the cook was just a sweet, dear person. And he just made me feel so much better. And it was very hard to wipe those tears away. Besides having a neck injury now, I had a head injury. I didn't feel good. But I went back to work. And I paid off my debt to the cannery. And my husband, he got his fish sold and stuff. But Anyway, and now you see so many people from different countries working in the canneries, and it's because they're cheaper labor. They're really cheaper labor, and a lot of them don't even speak English. And that's kind of, I've seen a lot of changes in Kodiak because of that. One thing I've noticed in the boat harbor has really grown. We also didn't have the bio drive in either, the bio dry chemicals were, when we brought in our boat, when the tide was out, it really stunk because all the rotting shrimp underneath the water. It was a very strong ammonia smell, and you could really, really get a whiff and almost pass out. That's really changed. But one thing that I notice now that just wasn't here then, and I believe it's because just like the shrimp has changed for my husband where he had to move on to another lifestyle, it has changed for the fish too. We have so many sea lions now that are all over our docks and walkways, and they come up on the boats too. And you wonder about walking on the dock. They weren't in town. They must have had a good food source. Their rookery was Chiniac, and you go by it, but you never saw a sea lion in the boat harbor or in the channel or anything. You'd see some other sea life, but you never saw the sea lions. The eagles were always here, and I've just always been just thrilled with that. I've seen them sunning themselves. I've seen up to 40 at a time in a small area, just sitting on fences and on the grass and with their wings spread out. The eagles have always amazed me. They're just beautiful. In fact, one sits in our tree right across the street. So frequently, I just wish they'd just put a nest up there because she's there every day, you know, almost every day. Okay, when I was talking about giving the Baptist mission over on Reznov, the halibut, that's how we started going to church out on the base. My husband shared his fish with everybody, and he's a very sharing person. He always has shared, and he took some halibut out to the base. The military base in those days was the Navy base, and it was a naval station, and he took it out to the chapel to see if the chaplain would like to give to anybody that could use a fish. And I can still see him sitting on the porch and just talking to the, we met at the chapel because it was an easy way of looking, you know, for somebody, and still see the chaplain sitting on the stairs, and Dick bringing out in his truck a big halibut, and kind of started going there when it was military, the Navy, through this chaplain. And we have seen a lot of changes on the military base. We've been going there basically the 26, 27 years we've been here. We've seen the military base get really run down. The Navy knew it was leaving, so they let it really run down. And then the Coast Guard came. We've gone to church there our whole married life, and I wasn't a Christian then, but I am now, and through my husband. But I remember one Christmas service is when the Navy, basically all the people were being, you know, were moving out, but there was no replacement people coming in at all. And so the chaplain was one of the last few people to leave. And for one of the Christmas services we had, it was the chaplain and his wife, Dick and I, and one other person, and we sat around a record player in the back room in the fellowship hall, and that's where we had our Christmas services. Then the Coast Guard had moved in, and the base was really run down. And I remember when those Coast Guard people didn't even get paid. They didn't know when they were ever going to get a paycheck. They didn't have any money. And the base is so run down. If you saw it then and saw it now, you couldn't believe the differences. It's beautiful. They've done so much work out there. A lot of new homes out there, and a lot of new buildings and everything. And now they're going to, here in the near future, I think in 96, I'm not sure, even the chapel is going to be renovated. They're going to have a whole new building on it, so it's going to be really different out there, even for us. Hard for us to take the changes. I have a hard time. I think the curtains were just put up last year, and my goodness, they were talking about 10 years ago, and I've seen three sets of curtains go by, and I think, well, why are you taking them down? They were just put up, you know, and new carpet and things like that. I'm a little slow on the change department here, but anyway, I see that they truly do need another fellowship hall because the roof's leaking. On the way to the base, and this is when my husband was on the Cubs and stuff, earlier I was talking to you about, I came when it was an upper road, and then I said there was a lower road, and now we have the road we have now going from town to base. But that, everybody thinks that landslide was there for always, and it wasn't. And a lot of people think that they don't know how that landslide was caused. Well, that landslide was caused by a person by the name of Red Mackey, and he used too much dynamite. They were pulling out some rock to make the New Sealand Dock, where it is now. They were using the rock from that hill to just go right over and put in the New Sealand Dock. And he put an overcharge. He put an overcharge in there, and that mountain came down, and that mountain kept coming down, and that mountain has come down. And in fact, it just another rock just last week came down and popped over. But I have seen rock come down. It blocked the whole road, by the way. Some of the rocks were big as hoods of cars. They were so big. And we were on the tug in the harbor right there watching it, and we filmed the whole thing. We sent our film in, and we never saw that film again, and we don't know what happened. But it was all on film. Whether the film was any good or whether we ever see the film again, I don't know. But we watched the landslide come beat by the, you know, standing on the deck of the tugboat, the Duncan Foss. When that happened, it was around Christmas time, because a lot of people were on the other side of the road going out and getting Christmas trees. And in fact, it was right before Christmas, I'm positive, because so many people couldn't get back to town. And that landslide just didn't go away. Those cars stayed over there. And that's where the state airport is on the other side, by the military base. And of course, town, everybody lived in town. And so what, you know where Gibson Cove is also my mother was going to come visit her first flight. Here she's nervous as it can be, her first flight, and she called me. I told her I would meet her at the airport. Well, I hadn't had a chance to call her back and say I can't meet her at the airport, so I know it was pretty close to right before Christmas. And she said, somebody's trying to grab her to get her on a bus, and she won't go. And I said, Mom, go. And she got on this little bus. It wasn't like what we consider a bus nowadays, but it was just a vehicle. And they got them down to, they took everybody from the airport down to Gibson Cove. And that is one steep road. That's enough to give my mother a heart attack right there. And here she's a little old lady, and they take her to the Gibson Cove, and then she has to go down this steep, steep ladder. I feel sorry for all those old people, and get on a fishing boat. And the fishing boat took everybody to the boat harbor, and we met everybody at the docks of the, and here, you're talking about this little lady on her first airplane ride, being pulled by strangers onto this bus to God knows where, down to this canary, and she has to go down this straight steel ladder onto a fishing boat into the galley there. They had, I know the boat, and I can't remember that name, but it was Oral Birch's boat, and who's a good friend that's now deceased, but he's a character in himself. But anyway, she got to the boat harbor, and she's just totally petrified. And it took her, I think, an hour and a half to get from the airport to town. You know, it's just 10 minutes away by regular car. But anyway, it's because the road's, and they tried to clear it, and since then they've built a whole nother road. They, at one time, they used cars, old junk cars, for barriers to prevent the rock from coming over. And those junk cars were there for years until they put these caged rocks in, and still it looks like the sifting of the rock off that mountain is going to continue. it's ever, ever continuing. It's not going to ever stop. And so this is the third new paved road on that road. It's really a riot. The signs were always up. It says, pass at your own risk. You know, landslide area, pass at your own risk. I can still see that sign as vivid as anything. And rocks were always coming down. You always get popped. And the taxicabs were the fastest. They zoomed there. Now the police want you to go 40, a little slower, so you can get hit a little bit better, I think, you know. But then right after that, you go 55 up a hill, you know. But anyway, that's the story of how that landslide got there. Was married 10 years before I had ever had children. I always wanted children. It just wasn't meant to be. And we never knew why, but we always wanted children. But Dick, by that time, had been called to Valdez for the pipeline, and he was one of the very few, I think there was only maybe two or three in the state, licensed captains of a tugboat, and he was very good at what he did. And so he went to Valdez to work, and the Duncan Foss had gone its way, and Dick had been out of work, and he was called over to Valdez, and very happy to get the job. But he worked, this is how we got our airplane. He bought the Cessna 310 that we have now, and he promised he'd come home every weekend. Well, I got to remember about these promises. They're questionable here, because I didn't see him for 3 months. But the plane was over here with me. I can't fly. The plane was over here. He was in Valdez, and he promised he'd come home every weekend. And I said, oh, yeah, sure. So anyway, he worked there for 2 years. And I visited him a few times, and I'll tell you, that's rough. Even a married woman walking with her husband wasn't safe over in Valdez. Mm-hmm. You know, and I felt sorry for any woman that had a daughter over there, let alone the mother. You know, it was a real rough lifestyle. And my husband worked nights on the pipeline. He's the one that brought in everything and built the docks for the actual pipeline. And he was one of the last to go, too. But I got to visit him a couple of times. And in fact, one of the planes, I said, I couldn't stand the high mountains over in Gifaldi that minute. But I couldn't stand the high peaked sharp mountains over there. I always was a white knuckle flyer, but I didn't mind flying. I just was scared looking out the window. Anyway, going over there, I said, I want to have a bigger airplane when I go home. And I got to be with him on the tug and everything. And of course, that wasn't allowed there either. And that's the only time when they have to have a boarding party. Any other time, my husband would be alone at night. And I was on board, and they had all the dignitaries they could think of. And I'm in the wheelhouse with my husband, and they are coming up to the wheelhouse to talk to him. And they say, who are you? I said, I'm Dick's wife. And they said, okay, and let it be. But they had all the Japanese dignitaries and all the pipeline dignitaries. We're talking really top people here. And we're escorting them from ship to shore and back and forth. And they're all partying. They're having a good time. And I was left alone to be with my husband. But I had to stay in the hotel room. I didn't dare go out of the hotel room. There was no radio. There was no TV. And he slept days, and I slept nights, and it was, why was I there, you know? But anyway, I stayed for a little while, and then I had to when I went home, I wanted a big airplane. Well, they filled up, and I really was very upset about taking the small airplane out. You know, we're talking only a few seats and stuff, but that's the only way I could get out. And I was told the airplane before this one that I went out on was the airplane that lost its wheel on takeoff. And I'm thinking, I wanted that airplane, and here's this wheel. You think I would have a heart attack? That would do it. And the tower said to the plane, your wheel fell off on takeoff, you know, right there in Valdez. And so when I got in the plane, which was very shortly after that plane, we landed in Anchorage, all on all this foam. The whole runway was coated foam, and I'm. You should have seen my face. I'm just so glad to go home and stuff. So I waited it out. But during this time, towards the end of the 2 years, I was fortunate to become pregnant. I was really, really excited. But there's where I think God got back at me. I really to this day believe that. Because I started throwing up to the time of conception to the time of giving actual birth. I was throwing up sick. And do you remember when I had no sympathy for anybody that gets seasick? God got back at me. I know he did. He showed me compassion for others right there. And I threw up in my, I threw up standing up, I threw up laying down, sleeping. And you think, by the way, being married 10 years, nothing to do, because I was lonely, they'd have me for court duty. But no, they have to wait until I'm puking sick to have me for court duty. And then they lose the paper in the mail and say they're going to have me arrested if I don't show up. So I call the doctor and get a copy of this form and hand it. But I also have to throw up on my way down, open the car door. But these are little stories of me just getting pregnant here. And I can't even look at the refrigerator without throwing up. And it was very hard. I was losing a lot of weight. In the end, I was sick a lot. And Dick did quit his job towards the end and just to be with me. He was offered a job in Valdez as an expediter for the pipeline. And because I was 7 months pregnant at the time, I didn't want to make a big move. I wanted to stay here. It's just one of those mother things, you know. He had the world on a plate to be offered to him, and I kind of ruined it for him. But I wanted to be here. And in the end, it turned out okay because Richard should have been born around Christmas time, maybe, I'm guessing. And he was born December 4th, and he was born premature. He was born, this is Richard Jr., he was born 2 pounds. And of all things, here we're on an island, and we talk about transportation and everything. We have planes, we have the Coast Guard, we have a hospital here. But the hospital couldn't keep Richard here. They had no facilities for any preemie of any kind here. They had an incubator. I never even made it to the delivery room with Richard. He was breech and he was purple and he wasn't breathing very well. And they all expected him to die. And I thought I'd never see him again. And the doctor and my husband, I asked my husband, run home, get his coat, because we got to the hospital so quick he didn't even bring his coat. And by the way, they said this was false labor too. You know, and I practically had it right here at the kitchen table. Richard was almost born right here in this chair at the kitchen table. I probably would have been happier right there, but I had to sleep with my head on the pillow right on the kitchen table here. But anyway, we did get him to the hospital. He was born 3:30 in the afternoon. After arriving at 1 o'clock, they told me to go home because I had false labor. And 2 hours later, I'm popping out a 2-pound baby. And Richard was almost full term. He wasn't preemie in age. He was preemie in size, and he would have always been small. And he was not doing too good. So the doctor, Dr. Wasson, in those days, and my husband got on a C-130 with Richard. The Coast Guard came in with their incubator and took him away, and within an hour of him being born. They do have a medic jet that comes out of Providence Hospital and stuff, but this is really the odd thing. We're always complaining about our weather here. We can't ever get off the island, and that's true, we can't. But the weather was bad in Anchorage. It was a 200-foot ceilings, and the jet couldn't take off. The Coast Guard ambulance came into the hospital down here in Kodiak and came and got Richard in their incubator, and they lashed it down into the C-130. And the C-130 number was 1501, I can still remember. Richard Jr. had his first flight at 1 hour old. The doctor and Dick went with him, and they got him over to Elmendorf, and then they ambulanced him over to Providence to a special ward over there. And in those days, the special ward was, the infant ward was just being, I remember walking in all the little babies. Oh, I wasn't allowed to go over, by the way. I wasn't in those days. I had to stay here, and the doctor called and made sure. And pretty much the nurses thought, they told me he was going to die, and I said, I want to wait until I hear from them. And a lot of people were praying for us, and I believe prayer made a big difference in our case. And I got a phone call, and Richard was doing fine. He was off oxygen. He was off everything. He just needed to stay in Anchorage to grow. And Richard wasn't immune to anything either. He was so small. He was just, oh, I can't even describe how small he was. His foot, they wouldn't even footprint him here. They wouldn't footprint him in Anchorage. And he was over 2 months old before they ever footprinted him. I was going to say, we stayed in Anchorage for 3 weeks, and they promised me he'd come home for Christmas. And they said no, he wasn't big enough, and so they waited till New Year's Eve. And in those days, stores weren't open. We didn't have anything in the house after being gone almost a month, and the stores were closed by 6 o'clock. And here he was in this this ward over there for special, you know, tiny little babies and any baby with problems and stuff. I should say that when I first walked in through the baby ward, I said, oh, which baby is mine? Because, I had only seen him for a few minutes, and he'd been gone for a week already. And they said, oh, wait a minute, you've got to come through here and you wash up more. And so we went through, and then there's a whole other room of babies. And they were about 1/4 the size of everybody else. And when I saw Richard, they said I almost fainted to the ground there. I turned white as a sheet because I already thought all those other babies were real tiny, and now I see mine as being super tiny. He could fit in a shoebox. He really could. He was, you can't even imagine how small a 2-pound baby is, and full term. And they never did find out why he was so small. He was a real regular little miniature. But that's good. His lungs were developed and everything. He was furry, but he was there to grow, and he recognized us, and we were there 18 hours a day, every day. For the rest of the weeks and stuff. On the way home, we had him wrapped up, and Wien Airlines announced him over the radio. And my husband held him up in the air, that was his second flight on the way home. He's been flying different kinds of planes ever since, or in airplanes ever since. But he was always really sick. When we got home, he stayed sick, so he was in and out of the hospital for years. And one thing I was going to say about Valdez, here Dick had this great job waiting for him, but they couldn't wait. Had he been born in Valdez, he might not have gotten out of Valdez during the wintertime. And he really could have died. And they wouldn't have had the facilities any more than Kodiak would have had the facilities. In those days, Kodiak was, the hospital was, administration was Catholic at the time. And they were in the process of changing hands to the Lutheran administration that they're under now, and they didn't have very many workers. And I said I'd come and feed my baby. He had to be fed every 2 hours, and he was only there to grow. But they wouldn't accept him here in Kodiak, and the doctors and nurses knew he was just here to grow, but they did send him home at 4 pounds, and I got to come home with him at 4 pounds. The normal weight is 5.5 pounds, and so they did let him come home. You know, to this very day, I don't know how much Richard cost, but I know the deductible took 12 years at several hundred dollars a month for 12 years. My little kid wasn't, I thought maybe they could keep him maybe for 12 years and then give him back to me, but it's fine. He's a good boy. He really is. He's a good young man.
Yeah.
And anyway, the hospital has grown and changed since then. I had Sarah 3.5 years later, or approximately 3.5 years later, and I had her breech also. I should have said Richard was breech, and I had Sarah breech too. This time I really did make it to the delivery room. It wasn't as easy. It was long labor and stuff, and I guess you're not in long labor like I was, and it was real quick labor. But she almost died too, and she stopped breathing a few times, and so we chose not to have any more children because one or the other of us was going to go and stuff. But one thing I noticed about Sarah is she always smiled, and Richard never smiled because he was so sick all the time.
Esther, I want to thank you very much for your time. This has been very interesting and informative, and I really appreciate your willingness to be interviewed.
Well, I really don't think I have too much to contribute, but I've seen a lot of changes. I liked it the way it was, but we have to grow with the times, and I hope Kodiak will have a better future. I know it's in a slump right now, but I hope it works out.
Well, thank you for sharing everything.
Well, you're welcome, Jessica.